The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Nancy Spain, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. And here's round one to test their vocabulary. Two marks if they get the meaning of these words right. Nancy Spain, what is tarantism?
Tarantism has something to do with,
Tarantella?
No, I shouldn't think so. That's a dance or a spider.
Yes.
Dance?
Yes, you've got both in one, I think.
It's a dance or a spider.
Yes.
And you whirl round like a mad thing when you've been bitten by the spider.
Yes.
So the dance is called the tarantella.
Yes. You've danced your way to victory, I think. it is a dancing mania. Originally in southern Italy, the people who did it claimed that they'd been bitten by the spider, the tarantella, the tarantula spider. And there it was.
The
tarantella was the thing you danced to cure yourself of tarantism, but that's quite different. Two marks. Thank you. What's an electrolier?
That's a sort of a man with a shocking smile. is it an electrically lit up luster?
Yes. That's it.
Electrolier. What it was called. Yes, it's a candle bar lit by electricity.
Passing quickly over both of those points, we agree. It is an electric chandelier. Two marks. Dennis Powell, what is a scarab? S-C-A-R-A-B.
It's a beetle.
Yes, what kind of beetle?
Well, it can be just a beetle, or it can be a beetle made of earthenware, or clay, or metal, which is sometimes found in Egyptian graves.
Yes, that's right. It's a sacred beetle of ancient Egypt, and it can be a gem engraved with various sort of hieroglyphs on it. Dennis Norden, what is a flaneur? F-L-A-N-E-U-R.
It's a thing over the A.
Yes, if you prefer it.
Yes. A marvellous word. Now, I took this in matric, a book called The Crime of Sylvestre Bonnard by Anatole France, and that was all about a flaneur, which is a stroller.
Yes.
A man who strolls along the left bank in Paris looking at all the bookstalls and so on and doesn't do anything except stop at and talk to the flower girls and what. And nowadays they say that it means a man who doesn't contribute to the national economic welfare and so on, but I don't hold with that. I think we're short of flaneurs, and we've got too many planners, and we should bring the planners back.
Well, that's a brilliant description. Two marks to Dennis. Lounger or loiterer, idler, so on. There we are. Well, before we start this next round, round two, I give each team a quotation, which they can write down if they want, and the two women members of the team will then, I hope, study their quotations. And at the end of the program, I ask them where the two things come from. Nancy Spain and Dennis Norden, your quotation is, "She stoops to conquer." And Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, yours is, "A thing of beauty is a joy forever." And then at the end of the program, I ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these words came to be said or written. And I don't want any of their answers just yet. Well, the next round is a round of mythology. Two marks if you get the answer right. Nancy Spain, who was Calliope, and in what way has her name now come into more general use?
Well, she was the muse of music, Jack, and she lived on the top of a rather uncomfortable mountain in Greece called Parnassus.
Yes.
And now she's mostly found in fairgrounds whizzing round above all those lovely golden horses and things.
Yeah, you better define her a little more closely in her modern dress.
Well, it's a steam organ.
Yes. It wasn't music, in fact. It was eloquence and epic or heroic poetry, but that's near enough.
I should have a lot of marks for that.
Two. Well, this was especially in America, the steam organ that you had either on a, whatever the thing's called, those steamers that go down the Mississippi, I can't remember, a stern wheeler or something, and also in merry-go-rounds at circuses. Frank Muir, who was Actaeon, and what happened to him?
Actaeon?
A-C-T-A-E-O-N.
It was a misprint for Act One. Yes. Yes. After a brief consultation with Dillis, he was torn to pieces by his own dogs.
Yes.
After he'd been...
Artemis set them on him.
I mean, he was torn to pieces, Jack. Yes. But these dreadful dogs with jaws slabby. Oh, 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 oh. He fought. But no, the dogs were on him, torn to pieces. Four marks. But next question.
But why was... Why was Artemis or Diana so unkind to him?
He must have watched her bathing or something.
And then these dogs... Ow, ow, ow! Slapping. Stag. Stag. There was he was turned into a stag,
that's
Jack.
It, yes, now you've really got him.
Ripped to pieces.
Yes, graphic scene. We're not in Act 1 now. We're on about Act 5.
It's, and it comes from Greek mythology.
He was a hunter. He surprised the goddess, Diana or Artemis, who was bathing naked in a pool, and she disliked this so much that she turned him into a stag and he was torn in pieces by his own hounds. Dillis Powell, who were the Valkyries and what was the significance of their ride?
Well, now, the Valkyries belong to a different kind of mythology, much farther north and colder.
Yes.
And they were the kind of daughters, more or less, or anyhow, favourites.
Yes.
With no... hostile intention, favourites or daughters of Odin. And when a hero died, they all appeared and they put him on their cruppers.
I think that needs some explanation.
And they took him to Valhalla.
Yes,
I think so too.
Yes, in that complicated and enchanting story, you've missed out one point. The point was they chose him in advance.
Really?
They decided who was going to die. These were handmaidens of Odin, and they were the choosers of the slain. And that's in fact what the word Valkyries means. So they came rushing down into the battle on their horses, and they picked out the chaps who were going to die. And then, as Dillis quite rightly says, they took him up to heaven or Valhalla and waited on him there, and he drank his large drinks out of the skulls of his enemy. Dennis Norton, what was or is a Bacchante? B-A-C-C-H-A-N-T-E.
Well, they were the things that you see tearing around the top of Wedgwood vases with sort of laurel wreaths tilted over one ear and cups of wine and all looking very sort of happy birthday, sweet 16. they used to hang around elderly Greek gentlemen.
One in particular.
Mainly Bacchus.
Yes. Yes, I think that's...
And they were called waitresses.
All right, near enough, Dennis, for two marks. They were priestesses or votaries of Bacchus, and they loved wine and had disheveled hair, just as Dennis suggests, and wore, I think it was an ivy wreath rather than a laurel one, over one ear, and clashed cymbals and were generally rather abandoned. Well, the next round is about origins and derivations, where expressions come from. And these are words and expressions which are very frequently used today. I want to know what they mean and also how they originated. Beginning with Nancy Spain. Nancy, what is a scapegoat and why?
Well, when something had gone desperately wrong with the tribe, herd or society,
mm-hmm.
you would pick on one unfortunate member of the tribe, herd or society and drive it out.
Yes.
And it would stand with its head miserably sunk between its forelegs, waiting in the snow to be painted by Mr. Holman Hunt.
Yes, and nowadays...
Somebody takes the can back.
That's right, carries the can. The person who takes the blame, who may or may not be very well guiltless himself, and it comes from the book of Leviticus, the Day of Atonement, when two goats, were taken by the high priest. One was killed and sacrificed. The other had the sins of the priest and the people transferred to him, and then was driven out into the wilderness. And there, as Nancy quite rightly says, the wretched goat shall bear upon him all their iniquities into a land not inhabited. Thank me, the phrase to go haywire.
It's to go berserk.
Yes, and why?
It means what it says, haywire. You see, hay used to be, Jack, used to be bundled together with twine. But the trouble was that it was all, you can never get long enough lengths, you know, never the twine shall meet. So they started, they started using wire.
Yes.
And this wire had this peculiar quality because it had phosphorus in it. And it had an effect on their nervous system, and people went all sort of doolally when they were baling hay. And they traced it to the wire, so they said, he's gone haywire.
It's astonishing to relate, he's almost entirely right. It means now to run riot or behave in a thoroughly uncontrolled manner, but it does come from the coils of wire which used to be used, particularly in America, for binding bundles of hay. And if you got this coil of wire a bit awkwardly, or if it hadn't been properly sort of wound up, then it would spring out into great loops and get in your way and become tangled and unmanageable. So that he was as near right as you can think. Three marks. Phyllis Powell, to go scot-free.
Scot-free. You didn't have to go to Scotland.
No.
And you didn't have to pay scot.
That's it. And scot is what?
Scot is, it's paying somebody's fine. Or to go scot-free is not to have to sort of pay anything.
Yes, that's all right. Go without punishment or without payment when you had expected you'd have to pay or have to be punished. It's an old English word for scot is for payment or levy or tax. I mean, it's sort of rates or taxes. And you paid scot and lot, which meant you paid the tax which was assessed, and the lot was the bit of the tax that which was appropriately yours to pay. I mean, it was your rate assessment, as it were. So that scot-free meant that you didn't have to pay the tax. Dennis Norden, costermonger.
Costermonger is a chap who sells things off a barrow.
Yes.
Know? Well, a monger is a seller, as
yes.
A fishmonger. And people come up to his bar and say, what's the cost of this? And what's the cost of that? Costa. What could he have sold? Costas.
Yes.
He sold Costas, which is an ancient name for something for which the name has been changed.
1.5 days, I think.
Well, I don't have to dot the I's on all these.
A barrow boy today, fruit, fish, etc. from a barrow. But originally it was a costard monger, which is a seller of apples. The costard was a very large apple, and that's what he used to sell at one stage, and was made it easier to say than costard monger, became costermonger. Now we come to the last round, and go back to the quotations I gave the two teams earlier on the programme. Two marks. Nancy, if you can give me the origin of your quotation, which isn't a very difficult one, I think. She stoops to conquer.
It's the name of a play by Oliver Goldsmith.
Yes. Dennis Power, the origin of your quotation, which was, a thing of beauty is a joy forever.
Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn.
No.
No?
Right author, wrong poem.
Right author, wrong poem. Beauty is a joy forever. Not Grecian Urn.
No.
No. Not Nightingale. Not Melancholy. There's only one more.
It's the end of Endymion. No, it isn't. I'm going to give you 1 out of 2 because it's getting too easy, I think. It's the opening line of Endymion. A thing of beauty is a joy forever. Its loveliness increases. It can never pass into nothingness, but still will keep a bower quiet for us. Nice, isn't it?
Lovely.
Opening lines of Endymion by Keats. Well, now I ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever unlikely explanation receives the longer amount of applause from you, the studio audience. So, back to Dennis Norden, his quotation, she stoops to conquer.
It was stock-taking day in the BBC sound effects department. I was working there at the time, some time ago when I first came to the BBC. I was working in the sound effects department as a junior storekeeper, which meant that my duties were roughly that if a radio producer had a radio play to produce, he would come to me and he would say, for my play, I want a... and a... and a... and I would give him the appropriate gadgets to make these sounds, and then I would write out a docket which he would sign, which said, received one... one... and a... Now, it may not sound much of a job to some of the more sophisticated, but it was necessary to have had a good schooling in order to be able to spell words like... and that was all my duties consisted of finding the appropriate sound effects when asked for, signing them out to the people, and occasionally just feeding Betty. Betty is the BBC seagull who is used in all radio plays connected with the ocean or shipping and so on. Is actually the successor to Esther, who was the original seagull, you know, who started with the BBC, when the BBC started 30 years ago, and who I believe is now a governor. But... there were three of us in the department. Myself, my immediate senior, who was a man called George Stopes, and Mari, who was a girl we used in murder plays whenever they wanted the sound of a body falling to the ground with a thud. We used to drop Mari. And the three of us were going through this department, listing, as I say, all the sound effects, or rather the gadgets for making the sound effects that we had in stock. And we came to the shelf marked simple monosyllabic sounds, which are rather sort of avant-garde sounds, like oink, doink, boink, and one which is only used in third program plays generally, which is g-doink, which is a sort of Brechtian sound, when the wagon falls on Mother Courage's foot, that you use this g-doink. And we've come to this shelf, and the g-doink was there, the boink was there, the doink was there, but there was no oink. Well, now, this was a terrible situation because we were the only ones who had the keys. Mari, George Stopes, and myself. If the oink was missing, it meant only one thing. That one of us had stolen the oinker. And then George Stopes broke. It's dreadful to see a man disintegrate. He said, all right, don't look at me. I stole the oinker. And then the whole story came out. He had purloined the BBC oinker to sell it to a wealthy American oinker collector for the sum of 8 and 9, which he had spent then in riotous living. He flushed brick red, and we didn't know what to say, because we knew that a man who can make a confession like this, a BBC man, for him, well, after telling us, there is only one course which honour dictates that he should take. Silently, I went to the shelf marked Sounds of Pistol Shots, and I took out a pistol shotter, and I handed it to George Stopes. He went behind the filing cabinet, and we heard the bang. Well, it's an ugly story. I don't pretend it isn't. There's no more left of it. We try to efface it from our memory. In fact, the only memory of it that is left is in the sound effects department still, where if you go in today for an oink, you will be led to this empty space on the shelf where the oinker was, and where there is now just a card, black edged, which says, G. Stopes took oinker.
That's a truly wonderful glimpse of nightlife at the BBC. And we go on to Frank Muir, and if you remember, his quotation was, "A thing of beauty is a joy forever."
Well, as I was saying, there's this sort of jar thing in the middle of our mantelpiece. You see, and that's what made me say it. That's really all it is. Do you want to know about the jar? Well, it's in my lovely house in the poor quarter of Surrey. They have in the middle of the mantelpiece, there's this sort of metal jar thing. It's called a conversation piece. When you have guests, they say, "What on earth that?" You see. And the reason it got there was because my wife, Mrs. Muir, said to me, "There's a bit of a hole in the centre of the mantelpiece, and this is before we had this metal object," and she said, I'd rather like you to get a Grecian urn, because my wife at that time was reading Keats. She has these terrible phases, you see, and everything's got to be under the Keats influence. And she said, "Would you get go out and buy a Grecian urn which will sit there?" So I said, "Yeah, well, of course, yes, sir." And she said, "Well, I think I'd better go, because, you know, we know what you're like. Your mind drifts off to other..." I said, "I'm perfectly capable, my dear girl, of going and buying a Grecian urn. Give me the money." So so she gave me £3. I took the train up to Waterloo, and I found myself in Soho. It was a sort of amusement arcade in Soho, so I had to go on the rifle range. And eventually I got really quite a pleasant vase. It wasn't Grecian. As a matter of fact, it was a vaguely vase-shaped, and it had a lot of seashells stuck all over it, forming the word mother. It wasn't very Keats, I felt, but definitely Shelley. I was very careful about this and wrapped it and held it at arm's length, and it started to rain. So in case the rain should melt the glue which stuck to the seashells forming the word mother on the vase, I thrust the vase under my raincoat and pushed my way rapidly out through the turnstile. The attendant was terribly nice and got a broom and helped me sweep up the pieces. Because the turnstile just coincided with the jar. And I now had about 17 shillings left, you see, my wife's £3, and still no vase. But I was walking moodily towards Waterloo, and I suddenly saw exactly the vase in the window of a private house. So I knocked on the door, and an awfully sweet lady came, and I said, I explained the whole position about how desperately I needed the vase. And she was quite kind. She had a sort of nip of brandy and then came back and talked to me. And she said, would you sell it to me? And she said, really? I pressed 15 shillings into her hand, and she seemed delighted. I think she was the Daily Woman, actually. And so I took this vase and I got the train back, and I was a bit early, so I went to the Red Lion, which is just near where I live, to have a quick one to celebrate this thing. And I was very careful. I put the vase on the counter, and nobody was around, nobody was near, and Mr. Blood, the publican, for that is indeed his name, poured me a drink. Now, he's got a dog, a very large Alsatian, and it's a curious sort of thing. Very nice animal, but a little curious. And it reared up, you know, and it licked my very tall vase. And for one dreadful moment, the vase hovered, and I thought it was going to crash. You know, but you know, this is the truth, it isn't a story. And it did crash. It absolutely smashed to pieces. And there I was, absolutely, with my train fare, I had sevenpence left, no vase. And a Keats loving wife waiting for her vase. And suddenly, it was fate again playing it just behind the sign on Mr. Blood's shelf which said hot pies, sandwiches cut fresh to order, I saw an old pewter tankard with the handle off. I said, how much for that? And he said, 5 bob, do you? And I said, quoting from Shaw, not likely, Blood. And he said, he said, how much then? And I said, 7 pence. And grabbing my pewter tankard with the handle off, I rushed into my wife and said, I've got it. And she said, well, where is this thing, which is absolutely wonderful and pure Keats? And I said, there. And there was this rather shabby, actually metal thing. She said, but that's not a Grecian vase. I said, Grecian vases are a very bad thing. Any vase made from China, I can tell you, it'll smash in a moment. The thing might last 10 years, it might last 2 minutes. But this, and I placed this awful little pot in the middle of our mantelpiece reverently, I said, this, well, in the words of Keats, a thing of pewter is a jar forever.
I think that's a dead heat, the amount that you gave in the way of applause to Dennis and to Frank, so I'm going to share the marks between them. And that brings us to a final score in which Dennis Powell and Frank Muir win by 1.5 marks from Nancy Spain and Dennis Norton, and it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton, introduced by Jack Longman. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. Oh, my God.